the Revolution Council of Concordia Seminoles would like to welcome you here this afternoon. And to keep our introduction of our student speaker rather brief, Mr. Neil Hunter was connected this year on a 6-month travel tour with the National Catholic Church of the USA as a special correspondent in a seminar on understanding China. He's trying to come to us today with a background. China's concern of having taught in Shanghai during 1965 to 67, and I'm sure it can give us great insight into the situation in China then as well as now. So I'll give you Mr. Neil Hunter.
I usually get introduced as a missionary from China, which is very embarrassing because I really. I just want to make a few brief remarks before I go to China. I find the pictures of China are quite helpful, even though it sounds like cheap stuff watching color slides. It does help to get a visual image of a country that we haven't really heard too much about in the last few years. It's not easy to talk about China and expect people to understand, or any country, but especially China, because of the gulf between America and China that's grown up in the last 20 years. I should say that the way my wife and I got to teach in China for 2 years was really pretty ordinary. We were living in England, and the Chinese government there has a chargé d'affaires, which is sort of one less than an ambassador. And we wrote to them. We knew that people were going to China to teach their own languages. A friend of ours from Australia had gone. His wife had even had a baby there, so we figured it couldn't be too bad. We wrote to the embassy and asked them what the possibilities were, and we got a letter back saying, come and see us. And also a form to fill in. It was a pretty typical form, I say, except that it had on it political party. Australians don't usually have a political party because voting is compulsory in our country. You're not political unless you have to be. So we just said no political party. And the other question that surprised us was religion. Yeah, we're Roman Catholic, so we didn't want to put that as looks too sort of sectarian. So we just said Christian. Sent the form in and returned letter. And we got selected to go to China. But we knew other people in England who had put on the form under political party, Communist Party, and under religion men, and they didn't get to go. So I think from that you'd have to assume that the Chinese were looking for school teachers, which is what they asked for anyway. People to teach their own languages. We went down to the embassy, had an interview lasting a couple of hours, and these people were our first Communist Chinese. Pretty ordinary, really. Very polite, cups of tea, Chinese cigarettes. Questions not really political at all. The only thing we discussed that could be called political was the Vietnam War. And this is 1965 when the bombing had started in Vietnam, and everyone was talking about the Vietnamese War. So I don't think you could call that really a political issue. They did ask us about our teaching experience. They didn't want to see any pieces of paper, which is a good sign, because so many people put emphasis on how many pieces of paper and references and letters after your name. But they were interested in our description of our experience. And they were probably giving us a test on the spot. If they could understand it, they figured maybe the students would too. Some Australians are not too serious. Anyway, a couple of weeks later, we got a letter saying we'd been accepted. So we were to leave, if we could, within 2 weeks. And we just sort of packed our things, which were in a chaotic mess, and flew out to Moscow and down across Inner Mongolia to Peking. I think we wrote to our parents when we got there. We didn't really have time to tell anybody. So they must have got a plane from Peking. My wife's mother had an interesting reaction to this. She's a very traditional Roman Catholic. Very anti-communist and has all the right attitude. Her letter said, you be careful there in Shanghai. And we thought, ah, here it comes. She said, the Americans could come and bomb that city, you'd be careful. There's more than one way to look at this whole problem. Anyway, we got to teaching, we spent a week there touring. We hadn't expected this. We were too early, it turned out, after all that luck. We were too early to start teaching. So the guy we were with, who came to meet us from Shanghai, said, how would you like a holiday? You must be tired having spent the last few months in England. You better have a holiday. So he took us up to the coast of Manchuria, some, I don't know, 50 or 100 miles north of the Great Wall, and we had a swimming and tennis holiday. I might mention that when the plane came down at Peking Airport, there was a great crowd of people waiting to welcome us. A lot of school children waving flags and simple colored paper flags. And some rather important looking gentlemen, as the plane came to a stop, we noticed that there were some familiar looking people there. They weren't dressed in any formal way. They had lemon yellow sports shirts and they looked very casual. The whole atmosphere, I might add, was very casual. No troops, no obvious security people, no weapons to speak of. We didn't know what to expect. Anyway, we recognized one of these guys. It was obviously Joe and Lau, come to meet the parents. And then we look again, and there's Chen Jin, the mayor of Peking, pretty important fellow. And then there's Jin Xiaoping, a little fellow who's the secretary general of the party. And we thought, this is good. This is quite a way to welcome foreign people. But it was for somebody else on the same plane. There was a man on the plane who was the head of the Indonesian Communist Party, much more important than us. And he got a great sort of Russian style bear hug and kiss on both cheeks type welcome. But we got welcomed with a bunch of gladiolas presented by this man from Shanghai. We seemed a small thing and we tend to think, you know, a bunch of flies, so just propaganda. But it never happened in any other country that we got welcomed with a bunch of flies. The man who welcomed us appears in some of these pictures, and he was a very ordinary sort of person. He was head of the English faculty in our college, and he had four daughters. He was also a member of the Communist Party, but I got the feeling that his daughters were really more important to him. He told us more about them than the revolution. His last year to come, he had to ride home on his bicycle at lunchtime to get them their lunch, and this sort of thing. This is how he regaled us with stories of life in Communist France. So we were really, right from the very beginning, we were with people. Very, very human people. And that was the good side of it, that we had somehow expected to find that communism had made China less human instead of more human. Looking back, I think it made the country more human. Especially after 2 years in America, I feel that communist China has a lot of very enviable qualities. Not that there's anything wrong with America, it's just that industry sort of run away with this country in many ways. And China doesn't have the problem of overcrowded cities, doesn't have the problem of polluted air and water. Most of its people are heavy, maybe 80 or 85% make a living growing crops. And that's their life. They don't think the same way as the city people do, and they don't behave the same way. Much more relaxed sort of country. Maybe I should show some pictures now. Is there something else? There are other things I would like to say about certain aspects of our stay there, which will probably come out in your questions, because I'm sure you have, you know, you each have something specific to ask. Some people will be interested in the Cultural Revolution. If you like, we can go into that. Other people in religion, especially Christianity in China. We can go into that too. But I think first I'll show these pictures. They only take half an hour or so, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions. First, we have to find a light switch. It probably won't be perfectly dark. Maybe we could shut the outer door. There's a lot of light coming through. Well, it's visible, isn't it? This is the man who met us with a bunch of flies. Very informal culture with a typical little bag that everyone in Shanghai carries, a plastic bag. Nothing particularly heavy to carry in it, just for some hope. He really showed us around what he was interested in teaching. He didn't show us very many revolutionary monuments at all. We expected that. He did show us some of the sort of things we must see, but what we saw most of were things like the Ming tomb, where the Ming emperors are buried, the Great Wall of China, the Imperial Palace, the Summer Palace. He was most keen to see all this because he hadn't been in Peking since back in the 1930s, and he was using this opportunity to catch up. So there we are looking at a sort of monument to one of the Ming emperors. Next. This is also the Ming tomb. We spent a whole day there, but they have made a great effort to keep up these palatial old buildings, which they consider national treasures. The Red Guards destroyed some things, mostly minor. The major buildings like this were protected during the Cultural Revolution, not damaged. Yes. This is also Ming tomb, and it shows a sort of different mentality that still exists in China, where you have this sort of more close union between man-made things and natural things. This is what I'm here and in my own country. See, we wouldn't allow a tree to grow out of a wall in a national treasure, where the two things compete, we would say. This building is very well kept up, but no one there seemed to mind it or find it one must destroy the other. They were both allowed to stay. That was the first commune we saw. We didn't go and visit this one. We are standing on the Great Wall on one of our visits, and you're looking at across a fairly typical North China village. Now, the land in the back belongs to everybody. It's not state land, it belongs to everybody on the commune. Now, that might be 20,000 people or more, and they certainly don't own it individually, but they own it as a commune, as a community. In the foreground, around each house, or beside each house, there's a small piece of private land that is owned by individuals. Husband, wife, and children have the right to a very small piece of land to grow vegetables, maybe keep ducks or pigs or chickens. And at certain times, they have been allowed to sell any surplus they could raise on their private land on a free market, a market that wasn't controlled by the government. The Red Guards had a few things to say about this. They felt that free markets, encouraging peasants to put more energy into their private sector, was really a step backward. I think the policy was introduced during a bad time. The Chinese suffered three pretty bad years, 1959, 60, 61, three bad harvests, also some economic mistakes, I think. And in order to get the country back on its feet, they introduced some policies based on the fact that man works better for himself. Several policies that the Red Guard criticized. Feeling the Red Guard said, sure, man works better for himself, but that's not the way it should be. And you couldn't encourage that. And if you go on like that, what's going to happen to the revolution? Which was really based on other principles. Yes. When you visit anywhere in China, everyone applauds you. It's terribly embarrassing, of course. Until you learn what to do, you should clap back. You never accept applause as though you're someone special. They're saying, congratulations on having had the sense to come and see us. And you're saying, congratulations on being revolutionary present or just Chinese people or whatever. But it's a dialogue. And you often see pictures of Mao Zedong clapping. And he is clapping people who are clapping him. As a slogan on the wall, we were told that we would be bedazzled by slogans. Everywhere we went, we would see writing on the wall and it would drive us mad. But in fact, before the Cultural Revolution anyway, the amount of the sloganeering on Chinese walls was really far less than the amount of advertising you get in any Western country, and far more restful on the eye, usually, especially for those who just couldn't read Chinese. So that's the Chairman Mao, that slogan, and there are two characters service to the right to say, long live Chairman Mao. My wife is scandalously dressed. You're not really supposed to show your legs as a married woman. It's rather immodest. The woman standing in the doorway is more typical. The photo is important because of the two men behind my wife who are party members. They are Communist Party members in charge of this commune, which is quite a big job. The important thing is that you could usually tell them from the look of them. They wore fairly neat trousers and a nice clean white shirt, and they had their hair cut carefully, and their faces usually didn't look as though they'd spent their lives in the sun. The real Chinese peasant is often burnt almost black, certainly brown, and his hands will be cut off. And these people were not still at the same level as the peasants, let's say. So already you have a hint of some kind of elitism, or a sort of easier life for a privileged class of people. The Red Guards noticed this, and that was one of the main things they were criticizing, not just in the countryside, but in the cities, throughout the country. Any kind of elitism was criticized by Red Guards. And here again you have some advertising on the wall. I mean, they are advertising moral qualities, if you like. This man actually exists. His name is King Andrew. Many foreigners have met him. He's the leader, not of a commune, but of a brigade. Now, where the commune might have 20,000 people, the brigade is maybe 2 or 3 villages administered communally, and it's got about 1,000 people, usually. Maybe a few more, 1,000 or 1,500 people. And that's what most people in China think of themselves as belonging to. They know their commune, but the commune is not so close to them. The brigade is much more part of their life. They identify with this small unit. Now, this brigade leader set out what the Red Guards consider a good example of peasant leadership. He was a peasant. He never wore a sort of fringe in his top pocket, sign of a bureaucrat often. He worked with his hands. He worked harder than they did, in fact. And he also showed qualities of leadership in suggesting things to be done. The work they did was very arduous. They lived in a dry, rocky, hilly country with poor crops and subject to waterways with rain and heavy storms. He got them to tillage these fields. And now they are sort of self-sufficient in the production of grain. And they did it without the advantage of any really heavy caterpillar machinery or trying to produce some of this, but not nearly enough. So he really stands for two things. One, leadership identified with the working people, and secondly, a sort of self-reliance, a spirit of self-reliance. Don't wait for the government to send you a caterpillar earth mover, because it might take another decade or a generation. So go to it with the tools you have. And don't expect the government to send you welfare or a handout should a rainstorm come and wash away your territory. Just build them again. And he is now the model for the whole of Chinese agriculture, as far as we could see, just in the last few years, and the Red Guards appreciate him very much. That's a commune street, back up in the north. Nothing fancy at all, no paved roads. The impression you get is one of very rural life. It's not unlike India or any other Asian country, except that it's obviously better in terms of public health, hygiene, cleanliness. And the people seem pretty relaxed. They don't all sort of put on an act to impress the foreigners. In fact, most Chinese peasants will stop work entirely and watch the foreigners all the way through the fields or wherever they happen to be. And modernization is, in fairly simple terms, the bicycle means a big difference. A lot of people have them now, and they can get out of the sort of limited rural life, they can get to a bigger town much more quickly. Bicycles, electricity, I suppose, and the radio are 3 of the main things, sewing machines also, but fairly simple improvements make a big difference in a peasant's life. Yes. Everywhere you go in the countryside, they are always very proud to show you their new tents, because making water go where you want it to is one of the age-old problems in China. And a government which can keep the water running where the peasants need it is more likely to be popular than one which is associated with flood or famine. People tend to think the government has lost the mandate of heaven if bad things happen during that particular period. If good things happen, then the government is assumed to have the mandate. This is an old theory, and people don't talk about it much anymore, but you get the feeling that it's still there. So this is where people in North China grow rice. And North China is not famous for rice. It grows much more easily in the south, more reliable rainfall. This is more wheat country, but they need to grow more rice. With water, they can. He still does an awful lot of work, and I suppose it'll be many years before he's obsolete. I just put him in to remind us of the water buffalo, who often gets left out of people's visions of China. You often see people working in a team, usually a small team, 10 or a dozen people. They hoe a field together. But you often see a man by himself like this, who's just got a clear gift, that's his morning's work. This is also in the north, and this woman looks after the duck, which will eventually be eaten in some firm like Peking duck, perhaps. She's very Chinese, nothing copied from the West really in her clothing or style, except perhaps the red duck. They copied some pattern, but the actual cut of the clothes is very Chinese. China is one of the few countries that has been influenced by Western styles, but has made them completely Chinese. It's even borrowed words from English and other languages. But these words have been given Chinese characters and put right into the language, pronounced in a different way. The Japanese, usually just pronounce the word in its original English or German style, and it sounds a bit chillier after a while. The Chinese tend to adapt things much more deeply into their own culture, and they may forget where they came from, which is good. This is a family down in the south, near a town called Hangzhou. Hangzhou is about 100 miles from Shanghai, perhaps. We used to try and go to Hangzhou whenever possible because it's quite a short train ride. Shanghai we found still rather a depressing city. It's one of the few dirty cities in China. The people try to keep it clean, but the British left all the factories downtown and it's an industrial city. The communists have built big satellite towns about 20 miles radius out of the city, but even so, Shanghai is not the most charming part of China, and it's also rather modern, 19th century city, not unlike Calcutta or Melbourne or British colonial cities. So we used to get out, and once we got to Hangzhou, we could go in all directions, go and walk in the mountains and talk to people like this. And we met a lot of peasants with them. They struck me as being particularly beautiful people. They had a bad time in the past. Hangzhou was one of the cities that the Japanese occupied. A lot of people were killed around there, and most of the timber was cut down for the Japanese war. So all this is rebuilt as far as forests are concerned. And you might also say that a lot in the people was a kind of rebuilt too. That woman at the back, see, this is a three-generational family. I got the overwhelming impression that most Chinese families still are three-generational, living in the same house. We tend to think the communists are breaking up the family, which is a slogan we have. And yet, in our own culture, we have somehow done away with grandparents. I don't know where they went, but they live in different suburbs where old people come. The Chinese still have grandma and grandpa living in the house, usually. That's the pattern. Which makes a big difference because it means we've got no babysitting problem to speak of. The old people feel useful, they can sweep the house, they can cook, they can look after the kids. But as I say, this family is not wealthy in the sense that they don't have running water in the house. Any American housewife would consider that the first requisite, running water. They don't. They work at the village well. They've got enough clothes. That's one of the major things, because the Chinese don't use much in the form of house heating. Even in a city like Shanghai, people don't use coal. Coal is very scarce. And I get the impression that a lot of people in China prefer to actually wear more clothes when it's cold and take these clothes off sometimes as the sun comes up. Layers of clothes come off. Our kids used to come to school with 11 or 12 layers, and we'd always peel back our sleeves to compare how warm we were. The old lady looked as though she might have had bound feet in the past, very small feet. This was a male-imposed custom, I guess, that the men seemed to have liked their women to work with rather delicate, minting silk. So the feet were bound from an early age. And if you think that's sort of oriental and cruel, you should study some of the things that Western men have made their women do, like well-bound corsets and the rest of them. This little girl in the center is exactly dressed because it's the Chinese New Year, and that's the time when kids get a new suit of clothes if possible, but certainly get dressed up in their brightest and red. Not because of communism, but traditionally, red is the color of joy. In that sense, the communists were very lucky. Some people say they only won because they picked that colour. This is a device for keeping the child still and safe while his mother does the housework. I only saw it around Hangzhou, but I've seen missionary photos since I left China are exactly the same, but I don't think it has any other use. It's certainly not a butter serum, as some people suggest, because the Chinese don't eat much dairy produce. I think that's just what it is. It's a kind of prison, protein, and bathroom combined. Anyway, it's a winter day, but sunny, and he's well rubbed up with his covered jacket. He can watch the village street, which is right here in the foreground. Yes. That probably focuses up a little bit. It's a picture of kindergarten children in Shanghai. Every time they move from one building to another, they have a habit of hanging onto each other's coattails. I think they're taught this from an early age. The boy is third from the front there, has a slit in his backside, but that's not a mistake. That's a Chinese device, probably as old as Chinese culture, for avoiding dieting. In theory, it's supposed to open up when the boy squats and close when the boy stands, but some of them get a bit old and tired. This is Shanghai too. I believe this park used to belong to some poet, because Shanghai's dead track. And if you find a hill like this, it's almost certainly artificial. It was built by someone wealthy who wanted to look out on mountains and rivers, even if they're artificial, he would have them made. This land was probably taken from such a person and given to the people, which would be perfectly in accord with the spirit of the revolution. This is a Sunday, which is not a good day for foreigners to go into a Chinese camp. All the kids have their day off on Sunday. And a lot of the population, the adult population. Although there is an experiment now with staggering the Sunday, putting it on different days to avoid overcrowding. All families only get one day off a week, even foreign people. But you get used to that. So it's not a good day to go into a camp because kids will follow you and snowballs until you simply have to run with your tail between your legs. Very curious, and they like to follow families. They're not nasty, they're just persistent. Yes. These are senior high school kids who have some extra exactly. That also is an artificial trend in the past. And I suppose this corresponds to American dating. The Chinese teenagers tend much more to go in youth. There's no such thing really in communist China of dating in the sense that you sample various possibilities. You might do this in a very practical way, but you do it in a group. My class would go out as a class or sometimes, you know, smaller divisions, but nearly always they'd go out boys and girls mixed, and I'm sure some of them were going to marry, but they would never let on, never tell you. And if you see a boy and a girl together alone, then everyone sort of assumes that they are going to be married. They're engaged already. It's a very moral approach, and some people say even puritanical. A lot of people complain that Shanghai is not what it was. Where are the bright lights and the brothels and the opium dens? But somehow I think I prefer it to both. No. This is an old man doing Taiji Chan, which is a kind of Chinese yoga. It's often called shadow boxing, but it's not a violent sport, really. It's more like a dance. You're supposed to empty your mind, as far as I know, and just make these movements very slow, like a slow motion movie. We used to see in the morning on our way to school, in the park, the old men, sometimes with younger people behind them that are following exactly the same step. And other people in the same park, of course, doing Swedish calisthenics, or whatever you call it, Western style exercise. But this was still popular when we were there. Here's another old man, I suppose, although he mightn't be as old as he looks. He's a Taoist monk, a Taoist hermit, or referee. He was on the tourist circuit, obviously, because here they take a busload of tourists to visit a hermit, which is not really fair. Later on, we met a lot more Taoists. We met a whole lot of Taoists. In fact, I think we met more Taoists than any other religious group. And we found them, in many ways, the most healthy religious group in China. I'll try and explain that in the next couple of pictures. This is Huashan Flower Mountain, one of the five sacred mountains of old China. We're aiming for that peak up there on the top right. And this mountain was full of Taoist monasteries. Some of them had only a couple of monks. Some of them had quite a number living there. But all the way up, wasn't a very difficult time, but all the way up on the stages there were these little ministries and the monks would serve you food. And, but we were very impressed by those people. You can see that we rather scandalized them. This lady in the foreground had less clothes than that by the time we reached the top, it was a hot day. And I think she set those four monks back quite a few centuries in their meditations, but anyway. Yes. That says, it's not taken from the proper fashion, there's still a good half a day's time yet, but you're looking down on the Wei River Valley. The Wei runs into the Yellow River, just out of that photograph on the right. Now, on the left there at the bottom, you've got a Taoist monastery, and up near the top on the left, there's another, and the path comes along that ridge. And then in the center of the picture at the top, there's a whole row of buildings. We stayed 2 nights there with Taoist monks sleeping just above our heads, making effort to some jokes, obviously. They were very happy sort of people. The whole thing there is sort of healthy youth is that my experience with the Christians and the Buddhists in communist China was that they hadn't really made very much of an effort at the grassroots level to come to terms with communism in any way. They were missing out in some respects on the good things that the communist government was doing. In a sense, when we went into a Catholic church, which we did every Sunday for the first year we were there, a Catholic church or a Buddhist temple, you got the same atmosphere. Maybe it's sort of a pre-Vatican II atmosphere, but I think it was really medieval. What you were going into was a different world altogether. And it had nothing to do with the spirit that was moving the Chinese people to do London, outside the churches. Now these people had got around that by, instead of just sitting on the mountain and being religious, in a kind of ghetto, they had formed a flower mountain service group. That's what they called themselves, and anyone who came up the mountain, they served. They gave him water and food, a bed for the night, or medicine, whatever he needed, they provided. He paid for it, but at least they were providing a service to society. And I think that kind of religious group would be much more appreciated by the communists. And I think it will last longer. It's just to say that some Taoist hermits were quite daring in their meditation technique. This building was actually unoccupied, we were told. So we had quite a lot of fun imagining what could have happened to the previous occupants. Now let's turn now to near the end, because even though we lived there for almost 2 years, it wasn't the most important part of China in many ways, because it's, as I say, it's a Western city. We were put for the first 9 months of our stay in an American hotel. It used to be called Broadway Mountain, but they quickly changed the name to Shanghai Mountain. Didn't like Broadway. And you're looking out on downtown Shanghai from our bedroom window. And when we woke up in the morning, what could we see but the Union Jack, the British flag, flying on that flagpole? And we were a little disappointed because we didn't feel we'd come all that way. After we'd come from England, and we'd flown right across the world, and we'd first change its own flag outside our bedroom window. That's true, we got used to it. Those three buildings that are going diagonally across the photo are the old British Consulate in Shanghai. That was really the best piece of real estate in the city. At the junction of the Suzhou Street and the Hangzhou River, which is on the left out of the picture. Now the grey building in the centre of the street was the old courthouse, where the, actually I think several of those buildings were used for a party, but the grey one was the main one. There was a great argument between the Chinese and the foreigners, because the British had all sorts of legal rights in that building. They could try Britishes who committed crimes on Chinese soil, which the Chinese felt was a great infringement of their own legal rights over their territory. We used to go to that building sometimes because it was the only place in Shanghai where you could see a Western movie. And they got the movie through the British Postal Service or something. And a lot of other people in Shanghai who were not foreign people, they were sort of refugees from maybe 30 or 30 years ago. Jewish people, white Russians, a lot of people used Shanghai as a refuge, running away from something horrible. And they were still there with their past and their old ideas. And some, you know, once a week they would come along to see a child hoping to see something Western, something, because, you know, it's not so easy when everything is Chinese and you are Western. You do want to see something that reminds you of your youth, perhaps, But what did they see there? They saw, out of 10 movies we saw there, I think we saw 3 over-friendly films. So it didn't mean much to these old people. Didn't mean much to our home. And just a few shots of industry, because you people know about industry, and Chinese industry, although it's interesting in some respects, is not the most interesting part. This is a dockyard in Shanghai, and the people here are in the designing room. But instead of putting their blueprint on a glass board, like I think we do, they like to sit, so they put the whole blueprint on the floor. You need a big building to design a big ship, I guess, that way. This is a woman doing what some people might think is a man's job, welding. I think my wife suggested to her that didn't she have a tough job? And my wife got quite a lecture on the role of women in modern Chinese society. It was pointed out that women had no political rights in the past, and now they are emancipated, they are liberated. And they can work if they want to, they can get the same wages as men for equal work. My wife had to admit that no, this was not the case in Australia yet. And on the whole, she was quite tough to talk to if you wanted to argue about a woman's role in society. Next. This is a basketball court set up by the workers on the same dockyard. Basketball is one of the most popular games, and table tennis, I suppose, would be the next. Maybe table tennis first. But they don't have a copy boat like our workers. They look out and play some sort of physical exercise. On the wall, it says, oppose American imperialism. I can't read the rest, but that's the important part, oppose American imperialism. That's a rather mild slogan. Usually it's downward. This is simply opposed, which is quite nice. If you talk to Chinese about this slogan, and you know, ask them what is US imperialism, they always distinguish very carefully between the imperialists in America and the people. We heard foreigners sometimes say, Americans are this, or you know, Americans are doing these sort of horrible things, and the Chinese would correct them and say, it's not the American people who are doing these things, it is the imperialists. We must specify that the imperialists are only 5% of the American population. The other 95% are friends of the Chinese people. Now, we used to argue that this was a very optimistic attitude. But we couldn't persuade anybody that it was not true. Now, all our students believed it firmly. They believed the same thing about the Russians, even though their leadership also was bad. They believed it about the Australians, and we still start to argue. Looking back on it, I'd say that I'm rather pleased that the percentage is the way it is, 95%, because it could be the other way around. It could be the other way around. It could be only 5% of Americans who are the good guys. When I was young, I was taught that all Japanese and Germans were bad. No one bothered to make the distinction to me in my childhood about Nazis and people. And I think it's a good distinction to make. This is just to say that a lot of work in Shanghai and China is done by pretty primitive methods. A lot of people have jobs simply to have a job. You know, instead of a lot of underemployment, if you like. There's no unemployment to speak of, but there's a lot of, you often see people doing a job which less people could do, or one machine could do very easily. But it's probably more humane to start with the attitude that you want everybody employed. That's the finished ship. Again, nothing particularly elaborate. Most of their products are pretty simple. No built in obsolescence that I could see, although I'm not an engineer. Simple, strong, and inexpensive equipment. This ship doesn't look like an ocean going on. It's probably a river traffic. They still do a lot of travel and transportation by waterways. But for these workers, I would imagine producing a ship would still be quite a kick. It's not so long ago that China had to import everything, from the simplest things to the largest. And now they can make a whole range of really very good industrial products. And I imagine they're not bored with their work yet. That's on the same river, on the same day, but it's centuries back in mentality because it's a fishing junk with an eye painted on the car. And the purpose of the eye was to frighten away evil spirits, so I would say, and make sure you catch a lot of fish. It's a long way in mentality from the previous trip. We were away in the summer of 1866, when the first free revolution began, every summer they gave the foreign teachers a holiday again, a tour around town. And we were out, well up in the northwest. In fact, we were in Yan'an, where the communists had their mountain base against the Japanese invasion. It was only when we got back to before this kind of slogan on the wall, and we imagined this must be where Dad's work, because the slogan said, long live Chairman Mao, the great leader, the great teacher, the great general, and the great townsman. Words to that effect. And most of these big slogans were very revolutionary in tone, and a lot of them were about Mao Zedong. We thought Red Guard, but later we discovered that it wasn't the Red Guard who put up these initial slogans. They were put up, and first the wall was given a coat of whitewash, by the local officials, who were scared that the Red Guards were going to come along and start criticizing the way the place was run. So in order to impress them and to anticipate their arrival, the party officials had the wall painted in nice big slogans put up in two places. They had a two-fold purpose. One was to impress the Red Guards with the loyalty and communism of these people, and also to use up valuable wall space which Red Guards might use for their handwritten posters. That didn't worry the Red Guards. It lasted, and they were overawed by this technique for about a week, and then they began to put their posters over the wall, which is quite something. This is what the Red Guards were doing from our experience, anyway. On the campuses in the big cities, they were putting up posters written with a document, often 20, 30, or 100 pages long. And they put them on the walls inside the building, of course. But pretty soon they filled up all the wall space. They filled up the dining room. In a room like this, they would even have clothes lines across from wall to wall with posters hanging from them with kids. They used up all the space. Now, a lot of those posters were typical of the administration. Nevertheless, the students demanded more space to put up their opinions, and the four officials, the administration, had to build them these special wooden walls. Out on their running fields, our campus had many hundreds of yards of them. This is not our campus, it's Jiaxing University, but the same thing applied there. So in other words, the party officials, or the administration, which were very closely linked, had to pay for the students putting up criticisms against the party officials. This is something like, I suppose, President Nixon and the cabinet appealing to SDS and being willing to pay for them to criticize the government of America. One of the things that happened after a few months was that many Red Guards began to move around China, and they left our institute in Zhou. Some of them went to Peking to see Mao Zedong because he was receiving them in millions. I think he received about 11 million in the space of 3 months in the big square in Peking. A lot of them went there. Others really went on a bit of a travel joint. I think they sort of went to see their relatives or see a brother in some city. That was a minority. A lot of them went to specific places. These students from our institute went to Harbin, way up in the north. And they went there because there's a foreign languages institute there too. And the president of our college had formerly been president of Harbin College. And the students suspected that she was a bureaucratic type of person, that she didn't really trust the students. And so they sent people up there to find out exactly what her reputation was, to bring back people who could speak for or against her. And in that way, they would find out what sort of person she really was. And it turned out that she'd been quite a martinet up there. She really ruled the roost, according to the students. And they brought that evidence to prove it. So these long marches were not just travel joints. They went for specific purposes. And also, on the way, they met a lot of people from social classes that they were not particularly used to. Most of these students had studied very hard to get where they were. It's not easy to get into tertiary education in China. And if you get there, you must be pretty bad academically. This is all changed now, since the Red Guards have abolished their entrance exams. But it was the case when we were there. This is a more elaborate type of poster. Most of them were not so well done. But this is a criticism of Liu Xiaoqing's wife, the wife of the president of China, ex-president Mao. The criticism was mainly because she wore Western clothes, she went to Indonesia and danced cha-cha-cha with Chris Tano, and smoked with a long holder, and then had photos in the church, drinking wine and wearing sometimes very short sleeves or sanguine neckline or thinner skirts. The Red Guards were shocked by this kind of behavior. They felt it was ill becoming for the First Lady of a communist country to behave like any old Western leaders, yeah, New South Wales. A lot of these students really knew their classical literature, not only novels, but also poetry and history. These are students who have come to Shanghai from other parts of the country, I mean, what they called long marches, imitating the Red Army back in 1934-35, which had to go on a long march lasting a year, and most of them were wiped out. These people were imitating that kind of survival tactic. And they came to Shanghai, many of them had never seen foreigners. We were the first people they'd seen. And all they had to go on was what they'd learned in school. So considering that they were very polite, very Chinese, very curious about us, but never rude. This is in the streets in Canton, Canton City, where I think the Red Guards had almost run out of things to say, too. Most of these are slogans saying, long live our group and down with your group. There were periods when there were little slumps, when people didn't have too much to say, and then it would come up again and they'd be putting much more details to the city. There's a cartoon there of the Red Guard having captured two or three revisionists or bureaucrats on his pen. Notice he caught them with a pen and not a weapon. One of the features of the movement was that it was supposed to be non-violent. It wasn't always non-violent, of course, but the Western press strangely omitted to mention the non-violent beginnings of the Cultural Revolution. But it was clearly said in the original instructions to the Red Guard, don't use violence. And Lin Biao, the defense minister, got up and said that you could change people's skin by hitting them, but you couldn't change their soul, so not to hit people. This is underemphasized in our reporting, so most people imagine this is a very violent movement. That's a party headquarters in Canton. It's been taken over by a Red Guard group, and they're hanging posters out the windows to explain. And a little three-wheel truck with a large speaker. Red Guard groups had the rights to quite a lot of equipment, and one of their rights was to have a three-wheel truck to go around broadcasting, if they were a sizable group. And round the corner, you sort of got another three-wheel truck that was going the opposite. Just a couple more. These are my wife's students, at least 5 out of 15 of them. All very radical. I call them radical, at least, because they were prepared to criticize the administration at our college. My students were not prepared to criticize the Communist Party at all. These students had no fear at all. Mostly they came from much poorer backgrounds than my students. The two girls there were from peasant origins, and the two boys from rather poor Shanghai working class families. And this is one of the occasions where there was violence on our campus. In fact, it was the only real fight between student groups. My art students, of which these are two, led a group of several hundred students to attack this building. They tried to get into this building, and my students and several hundred others tried to stop them getting in. The cause of this dispute was that in this building were the administration offices and the Communist Party committee office. That was where the school was run from. It was a new building, which might also be a sign of bureaucratism, the students thought, you know, why should the party and the authorities have a new building? You see that they've gone through the same length to make themselves seem revolutionary. The big picture of Mao, electric light bulbs scattered all the way around it, and it's beautiful. The Red Guards didn't care for that, they broke in. What they wanted to find were the student records which were kept in this building, because the radical students had an idea that their names, their records were being tampered with by the party officials. In other words, that when one of these radical kids put up a poster criticizing the administration, then a little note would go down in his dossier saying something like, tends to be anti-communist. Now, in China, that's a very serious little note to have in your records. It's about as bad as having in your American record tends to be a communist. It's not as bad as that, maybe worse. And so this was forbidden. During the Cultural Revolution, an order went out from the center saying No records must be kept of any student activities during this movement. Records which might be used later to punish these people in some way or repress them. Every student must have the right to start with a clean sheet. And any such records that were suspected were to be brought out and burned publicly in front of everyone in the college. Now, of course, our county authorities wouldn't do that because that would be admitting that they had these records. So they kept them and they wouldn't let the students look at them. They said it was a state secret. And the students said, you know, we are the people kind of thing. And they went in and found them and found that they were right. In fact, the county had been trying to repress the radical students, even sending people to their homes to check into their family background to see if they really came from working class families. And this was one of the occasions in our college. In fact, it was a turning point because many of the uncommitted or more moderate or even conservative students realized that the radicals had a point or two, that they had in fact been repressed by the administration of our college, and that was really all you had to do to prove your point in the Postal Revolution, which was basically a move to get rid of your bureaucratism and take up the Communist Party. That's the end of the pictures. I don't know whether that looks like China as you imagine it, but that's the way I saw it. That's part of it, isn't it? Maybe we could have some lights and then we can. We've got time to have questions. It's now three. We have one question anyway, not a question. Soldiers didn't become Red Guards. Almost everyone in our college became a Red Guard. Unless your father was a very wealthy landlord or businessman or something. And then you would be suspect because you came from a bad political background. But most of our kids became Red Guards. But they were by no means limited to students. That was only in the beginning. The movement started in the colleges and they didn't really get to anywhere. They didn't manage to bring out real folk in the functioning of the party. But they spread them into the factories of Shanghai and into working class areas in other cities, and they made a kind of alliance with similarly minded workers. You got the same split between radical workers and more conservative ones. So really, workers were more Red Guards than students. They were more worker Red Guards. Later we had peasant Red Guards, and Red Guards from offices in Shanghai, clerks and journalists and all kinds of people. What about the Christians? Well, that's a subject in itself. Would you like to go into that? Well, we, besides the availability of practicing religion means, during 1965-6, our first year, there were churches to go to. We went to two Catholic churches, one for St. Joseph's in downtown Shanghai, and the other for Chikao, which is a very famous cathedral in the west of Shanghai. Now, these churches put on to the average Catholic masses. Except as I say, they were pre-Vatican II masses, in the sense they were still in Latin, the priest didn't face the altar, and the atmosphere was still rather somber. The people who went to these services were mostly old people, there were some youngsters, and some children. In Peking, there were more younger people than some. We went to Peking about 5 times, and sometimes we were there on a Sunday, and we dropped in. The Catholic churches there seemed to have more young people. And they talk to us more, and somehow they hardly ever spoke to us. They hardly ever spoke to each other. The Protestant churches in Shanghai seem to be somewhat better. At least the Church of England Cathedral was a much brighter place to go to. We went there several times. We were welcomed by people. They spoke to us. They showed us how to sing the hymns, and they had a sermon. The Catholic Church never had a sermon. So, I mean, religion functions. There were Buddhist monasteries operating all over the place. There were these guys, and Muslims, and now, when the Cultural Revolution came along, the Red Guards took it into their heads as part of a campaign against all things from the old society that didn't fit in with a socialist base, socialist economy. They closed down the churches in Shanghai. They closed down the churches in Shanghai. They didn't go to church for our second year in China. Now, some of those churches have been opened and some of them haven't. All I'm trying to say is that as far as availability of religion was available to people from 1949 through 1966, and it probably will be again in the future. That's really not the only point of issue, however. It's really the quality of the religion also that should be considered. And I feel that the quality of the official traditional churches in China was poor. And I feel it was poor not only because of communist repression. Obviously the communists don't like these things, but they have an attempt usually not to try and test them. We were told on our first day in China by that same guy with the church and the four daughters. He went past the church and he said, "Oh, look, a church." And he said, "Yes, the church is open. We don't shut them down because we know the people would go and reading the Bible in bed." This is probably true. So they're not driving it, but they would like to see the end of those religions because they consider them outmoded and positively harmful. We were told once or a dozen times in China that Christianity was essentially a selfish religion in the way it had developed through the church. That it trained people, it encouraged people to think of themselves first, to save their own souls, to do all kinds of tasks. Yes, true, but their real aim was to save their souls. Now, whether that's a fair commentary on modern Christianity, I don't know. Maybe it's a fairer one in 19th century Christianity, which will have a lot of influence in time. I found much more spirituality in the society outside the churches. I felt that there was a much more religious atmosphere. The people were conscious of other people much more, were working for other people much more. All the things that I consider real Christianity were going on outside the Christian church. That's why I've been puzzled ever since. That's what really started me wondering about communist China. The fact that it was rather a shame to be a traditional Christian in China. People also associated with all sorts of other things that happened. You know, the Christians came with the military and the businessmen and the treaty makers who sort of tried to carve China up into various treaties. Now, anti-Christianity is not confined to a communist party in China. It's quite widespread. Especially, it was very strong among the young. Back in the 30s and before. In the 19th century, a man in Harvard wrote a very interesting book on the attitude of the Mandarin, the scholar class of China, to the Christians. That's a long answer to what I consider deserves a whole book.
Thank you very much. I think it's 5 minutes after 3 now. We take about a 10-minute break, and then we assemble back here quite a few more questions, I would hope, to a little after 4, or as long as we care to go. So let's take a 10-minute break now, and be back here at 3:15. Bring the people in from the back of the hall, of our discussion going this afternoon. We have thought of inviting several people to make the initial questions to Mr. Henry, but in hopes that this might keep a little bit less academic, we simply ask any one of you who have questions for him to step to one of the two microphones and so everyone can hear the question and direct your question to him, and I'm sure he'll be more than capable to handle the question. And he will recognize either microphone in turn. So I'll give you back to Mr. Henry.
I'd like to hear people's views, not just answer questions. So if you have statements to make, please do. I'm sure my impressions of China are not accepted by everybody. I mean, there's no reason why they should be, and I'm sure my ideas on Christianity are not unorthodox. Would you like to use the microphone when everyone can hear you? Or would you like me to repeat that before? Haven't they the right? Yes, but they are not surrounded by Americans. They don't see it that way. They see themselves. Yes, but that's not just Americans. They say we are surrounded by certain people, by philosophy, if you like. We are surrounded by a philosophy which is aggressive. But the Americans are soldiers sent by their government, and they are working class people on the whole. Black people, white workers, often quite poor people, the people who can't get out of military service. Then we get into a discussion of democracy. But they don't, and you can't get this way of findings on the mainland that the actions of the American government represent in any way the beliefs of the American people. They don't believe in representative democracy through the parliamentary system to a certain extent, but that's not real democracy, that's not people's power. People's power is poor people's power, and the poor people don't make American foreign policy. It's the wealthy people in this country who make the policy, they say. And therefore, it's American imperialism they speak of, and not the average American girl, who is a good person. But apparently you don't need to divide the American people. The papers are full of the stories of division. The Chinese didn't cause the American polarization. You don't need the work of it to divide the Americans. There is a severe division between generations, between different kinds of people in this country. I don't think it's just a political effect. I think it's a genuine belief that stems from their Marxism. If an American soldier comes into your country or into a neighboring country with a gun, he is an enemy and must be fought. If he lays down that gun, he becomes a class brother. This is pointed out often when it is told to us in story form by people who acted as interpreters in Korea. That American black people were often very relieved to see when they went to the prison camp that they were class brothers and not aggressors. I had expected to be treated harshly, and I found the Chinese saying, "You are exploited people, the same as we were." So you might say that's a political gimmick, but it must have been a relief for the prisoners, yeah. I know it's difficult. I used to listen on the radio in Shanghai. We had a Shanghai-made shortwave radio, and we could reach practically every major Western broadcasting station. We got Australia first here, we got the breakfast station, and all those people ringing in for the special sound. But we had the BBC and the Japan and Voice of America, and they kept telling us that there was a riot in Shanghai, there was concert in Shanghai, and Shanghai was this. And we were there, and they would stay there this was, and we would get on our bicycles and go see. And there wasn't a riot. And there might have been a student demonstration or something which made this report. But it wasn't the way that radio said. And so I began to doubt the validity of the press report. And they might have stopped from some point of fact. But they had a tremendous bias against China on the whole. Even the New York Times, which is one of the better papers, they tell me. And probably tries to be liberal in this respect, but still really not sympathetic with the Chinese in any way. And so it's reporting usually turns out to be, it's not that they often treat inaccuracy, they just don't report the important things. They leave out the fact that China, a country which has suffered as much from violence as any country in the last 100 years, And when you think of all the warlords and the invasions and the upset of this tremendous empire that had lasted so long, and the millions of people killed, which is at least as many, the Taiping Rebellion, how many people killed in that? 20, 30 million? That was a terrible thing back in the 1950s. Here you have a Mao Zedong sort of talking about a non-violent movement. You're just trying to get these crazy men Martin Luther King type ideas. That should be reported in the press, that's very important. Especially if these American troops are sort of eyeball to eyeball with Chinese along the whole perimeter in Asia. And I think that's the important thing. And it's not so important to go and find all the little individual pieces of violence we could kill. Sure, that should be reported, but not even the first place. Do we forget that we are a very violent people? We kill 50,000 people in automobile accidents every year. And we don't do anything to stop it, really. 50,000, much more than Vietnam, that's very few. I wouldn't be surprised if the Soviet Union didn't kill anything like that number of people. But we report it if we are very violent. We have institutionalized violence. The Chinese don't even have medicine. I think the truth. No, I don't want to say that. I mean, what we should get is a mixed picture, the bad and the good. But I do think that if you're starting off to understand a country which has been through what China's been through, then you have to sort of learn to feel like a Chinese person, because he's the one who suffered most. Not the intellectuals. The army papers mostly start with the intellectuals. He had suffered to some extent under communism. The wealthy people, and the people who fled from China, the landlord class, many were killed. These people have suffered, but these are just tiny proportions. But we should start speaking about what has happened to the poor, particularly as Christians, and to start speaking about the poor, which is what Christianity is about. This is what we really speak to the next time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's pretty hard to make Chinese feel isolated, I think. They're very much at home where they are. Relations with other countries are important to the government, I imagine. Trade with other countries is important. They do trade, I think they've trade with over 100 countries. And they have diplomatic relations with quite a lot. Certainly they have arguments with them, and they couldn't really happen. Students in Burma want to wear Mao buttons and they can go to national campus. But on the whole, you don't get the feeling that China is isolated. Especially if you live in Shanghai and see this tremendous river full of shipping, all kinds of sailors visiting. The Chinese have a very strong attachment to China, so much so that when you have a leave, they kind of assume that you can just kind of understand that you're leaving, not in the army over there. We said, well, we're going home. Well, I tell you, couldn't really take the people from somewhere else, could it be?
Dr. Henry, do you feel that your picture of Burma is critical? Of the people there, I guess, you know. Because, like this gentleman here, the picture you presented is very different from what I've been doing. It really is a pleasure, in a sense, to see you. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I've been taking photos during the post-revolution of people wearing high hats, and they're being humiliated in public. But I mean, the rest of the person is full of these stories, you know those stories. I don't need to emphasize that. What I think people forget is that the people are prisoners. Most of the people are prisoners.
Could you have any trouble taking those pictures or getting the phone out?
The only time I got in trouble taking photographs was when I took a photo of a little girl in a scooter. And we've been told when we arrived in China that there might be trouble unless we ask people for permission to take the photo. But we never did, because when you ask the Chinese that, you go like this, and the Chinese really became the new one. And we're in the photo. So all the time we took pictures of photos, and we got on the street. And then, this girl got a scooter made of pieces of wood that his father had sort of wrapped together with pictures of our family. And all of us are here. And they go swimming around in the same time, and they go, they look at the photo, and they're about to go to the right off, and then I had a feeling something was wrong, and I looked back, and the whole street was coming up to me. And they were like, and they had a long discussion, and they got 3 quarters of the news. Other people, this is once you know what I'm talking to, well, don't you do it? Didn't know what this story is, what they were doing, and they were like, and other people came up and said, I saw you taking a photo of a building up there. And other people came up and said, I saw you taking a photo of the river boat up there. And really, it's a real case against you. You just go down in the middle of the country over here. So they tried to get an arrest of you for teaching. There was like a single family party in there, the policeman and the military man there. And these were the people in that street. It was Bear Street, I sat in Bear Street, I took a photo of the Bear building, and I could have been out of the country. So they arrested me, and I had to go very fast to get out of that. Finally, they took me to the police station, which was a relief, because at least you had a receipt of it. And I felt like I didn't really trust the man in my story. And they still had to say, I should be arrested by a cop, because you know you've got to write a report, and you've got to do something. So this is domestic news to have a real meaning of peace in time.
Well, one final question, and that is, do you feel that the Chinese people are comfortable with communism, the Chinese government and stuff? I would think, from what you say, that their life is much better in many respects, since these years of reality.
I think mentally they're more comfortable than they want. These people certainly don't have a very high standard of living from any American point of view. But then Americans have a very high standard of living from an Australian point of view. So it depends entirely on your standard of comfort. But I think mentally and spiritually they're better off. Because I think even for intellectuals, a lot of people didn't really know what it was to be Chinese anymore. I've come serious in the last 100 years of Chinese history. Because you saw ancient empire was overthrown, long before the Chinese. So you can tell a whole rethinking of values. And they thought throughout all the Western methods to copy this or to adapt that, and how much of the old time it would keep. And finally, this provides what I consider one of the most logical answers to this question. What it means to be Chinese. And I think even the people I've talked with, who were often criticized by the students, are the Western educated Chinese intellectuals. They still like living in the country, even though it's hard for them to change. What is comfortable, what is comfortable, they were continually being asked to answer for their actions. This criticism is self criticism goes on all the time. At least once a week, they're likely to have some sort of question, often it's just a form of them. Sometimes it's just quite severe. Imagine them putting up in a struggle session when people can be accused of quite serious crimes and get the hard hustle that throws around and humiliates. It's a society designed to keep people humble. And no one wants to be humble. The prison is done up the road because they're humble at the beginning. Yes.
Thank you.
I'm like in 64, 65, and up around the Zhebzhan movement, and I've been looking at the observer as I was trying to believe that the conference of revolution was the biggest success African market in Korea. And if you compare to the Greek revolution with the Great Leap Forward in 1968 and 1960, I think many people believe that the Red Guard movement is a worse mistake than the Great Leap Forward even. And for you, who has been living for most of time during the conference of revolution, what's your opinion really about that?
Well, I have to look at it from two points of view. One, as a teacher in Taiwan, to have trying to work out what was happening. I didn't have a clue what the Cultural Revolution was about. And I think a lot of Chinese people were equally baffled. That's why there are all kinds of things which were sort of dead tigers. Still, actually, they're sort of dead tigers, like a couple of intellectuals and professors. That's all it is. I haven't got any power anyway. You're with the people. And I have to watch this and see now what this is all about. And finally, you have to have this as a movement against reactionaries or people with selfish mentality within the communist camp. Okay, that's one angle. And then I have to try and imagine what is going on in Peking. And as a foreign teacher in China, I'm not really entitled to sort of think I know anything about what is happening in the central tradition, more or less. I'm in the country. But it seems that it was a magical idea, I think, the Cultural Revolution. It was designed for many different purposes. We've obviously been thinking about it for many years. And I think it can hardly be explained by the fact that Mao Zedong did not have power in China during the 60s. He had a tremendous prestige. I don't think he had control of the Central Committee. And I think in the Communist Party, I don't think he controlled it. And the only way he could get back in.
When the Red Guard took over everything and everything was bad, every activity, including in the race in the Russian camp, and also, so everything took bad, and then for the whole communist party is the go on the fashion. It has been fashion because they really think that after the 67, 68, the fashion really too strong. And many fashion could close to Russia. And close to Mexican theater, close to Lee Sarsi, close to Lundy, and also the CMI has his own fashion. So, as the future of China, it seems to many observers from outside China, just like China is working now. And then I'd like to see if you agree with that, with the market.
Because we have our money, which has come in to keep these people in the country.
One last question, is that if you're here, you see, if Kevin's now has a committee combined, and then if now you look at the committee to see that way combined, that you compose mostly of the work in the Russian and the military, especially in this time. And it turns out after the Red Guard movement, and after when the party left our control, so the all the fact in the West China as a very strong force with the army. All the power. And then the army is now when everything is much more power and control in control of the party or the Red Guard movement. So the new thing that was the attack of the army may take over either before or after 1915.
Thank you.
the